Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
I'm surprised sometimes by what we do and don't learn at school. Not that I'm expecting kids to learn all of everything by the time they reach year six, but there really are some very important parts of our history that we know too little about. We touched on this a bit when we talked about historian Henry Reynolds recently and when we mentioned the Mile Creek Massacre. Len Waters is someone I didn't learn about at school. And what a shame that I didn't. He was Australia's only World War II Aboriginal fighter pilot. A heroic figure by all accounts, had an important war, fought for his country. But at the end of the war, he was rejected by the society he fought to defend. Len thought after the war he could put his skills to good use and become an airline pilot. But he didn't count on what is no less, I think, than just inbuilt racism of Australian society in the post-war years. At one stage, his widow was even denied a war widow's pension. The reason Len Waters' name might ring a bell for you is that it's been part of the discussion over what to call the new Sydney airport at Badgerys Creek. And it was that discussion that sparked an interest in Peter Rees to write a book, The Missing Man, which tells the powerful story of Len Waters.
The war ended in 1945, and with that flying experience in the services and the RAF behind him, Len had hoped that he'd be able to be part of Australia's aviation future. As it turned out, he was thwarted in his efforts to get a commercial pilot's license, and he just had to take up other employment. As he told his wife, Gladys, who's still alive, still with us, I guess I'll have to go back to being a blackfella after he'd exhausted all efforts to get his license.
Yeah, this is the two worlds idea that you advance in the book. Well, Peter, let's go back then. I mean, I said I didn't learn about Len Waters at school, and it's shameful that we don't know about him. This is a story that had to be told. I'm so glad you've told it. So back to the beginning, Len Waters, I suppose, could have been one of the stolen generation, couldn't he?
Well, he could easily have been, and that was why the family moved from the Toomelah Aboriginal mission in late 1901. They were very keen to get away, to take up employment. An opportunity had arisen for Len's father, Don, to work on a property on just the other side of the border at Nindy Gully in Queensland, only a couple of hours or so away from the Toomelah Reserve. I've spoken to Len's younger brother, Kevin, who's still with us, and he described to me some harrowing scenes of seeing Aboriginal children being torn from their mothers at Toomelah. And the family was very keen to just get away from any risk of this. And they were lucky enough to get permission to leave because of the employment opportunity that their father, Don, had.
Yes, you get a strong sense of family from the story that you've told. 1931, they moved from Toomelah. They went up to Queensland, and then a succession of jobs takes place. And there's some issues about schooling that I'll leave for people who read the book, but let's fast forward to the 1940s. Now, we're at war with Japan, and something quite fascinating that you've drawn out in your book is that for Indigenous people, the idea of Australia being attacked, taken over by the Japanese, meant as much as it meant to the white population, but in a sense, 60,000 years more than that, another invasion.
That's right. And what made it worse was that the Japanese attacks caused the backlash against Aborigines. There was a widespread belief that they were likely to side with any Japanese invasion force. And this led to a situation where many Aborigines were relocated to what were known as control camps, and restrictions were placed on their movements, especially those of women. And that there was a rumour that spread that there were orders to shoot Aborigines should an invasion take place. I mean, it just gives an example of the harsh attitudes that they had to deal with at that time.
It's extraordinary to think about that today, but now extraordinary again that Len Waters like a lot of Aboriginal people, wanted to do their part. They wanted to sign up and join up. And for Len Waters, his desire was to be in the RAAF. Nothing he did was without difficulty, was it?
Oh, that's right. I mean, he had this boyhood dream to fly. He used to make model aeroplanes and run along the banks of the Moonee River. Wow. At Nindy Gully, where they lived in a tin shack with a rammed earth floor. And he would buy aviation magazines and just he buried himself in this dream of flying. And it was World War II that opened the opportunity, and he grabbed it. He first of all became a flight mechanic, and he sensed that with the need for numbers increasing, that if he applied himself, he just might be able to remuster to aircrew. And this he did. I mean, Len was the sort of person who, when he saw an opportunity, grabbed it. He went for it. He had this self-belief, this determination. Mm. He had those personality traits that fitted him for aircrew, for flying, to become a pilot.
Now, how hard did he have to work at that? And was his Aboriginality constantly against him as he worked through the ranks, even to the point where he was able to do the basic pilot training?
Yeah, well, we're dealing with somebody here who had to leave school to help work for the family, to put food on the table.
Yeah, which was a ring barking business, of all things.
That's right, exactly. And he had to pass up the opportunity of a bursary to a private school, Brisbane Boys Grammar in Brisbane, because of the need to feed the family. Mm. And he left school before the age of 14. Mm. So in the Air Force, to become a pilot, he had to really apply himself, study every night. And this is what he did when his mates were out at out in town at the various places that they were training. Mm. He was at home, back at the base, burying his head in books, flight manuals, the physics of flight. He was determined to get the educational standards so that he could pass the tests to become a pilot. And in the ultimate, when he got his wings, he graduated near the top of his class.
Our guest is Peter Rees. He's the author of The Missing Man, the powerful story, as the cover says, and it's right, of Len Waters, Australia's first Aboriginal fighter pilot, and as far as you know, Peter, Australia's only identified Aboriginal fighter pilot. That in itself is not just fascinating, but telling. Peter, what sort of pilot was he?
He was highly respected by comrades, one of whom was Dr. Jeff Cutler, the brother of Sir Roden Cutler, the VC winner. And I quote Jeff Cutler in the book as saying that he would rather fly number two to Len than to pilot in the squadron, in 78 squadron, and to which they both belonged.
So he had success as a pilot, and he was well regarded by the service itself and by his colleagues. But yet, as an Aboriginal man, there's a story that you tell of Len and his brother trying to go into a pub in Moree. Now, bear in mind, Aboriginal people were not citizens, not full citizens, until the 60s in Australia. So this is the 40s.
Yes. Well, the incident that you're referring to, Stephen, happened in Moree, and it occurred when Len had not long graduated with his wings and converted to Kitty Hawks, and was going home to the family in Nindy Gully. To do so, he had to go via Moree to catch the train from Sydney to Moree and then hitchhike, got just over the border. And this was just before he was to be posted to the islands, the Southwest Pacific, to fight the Japanese enemy. And his brother, his elder brother, George, was living in Moree. And he thought he'd catch up with George, and they'd have a beer in one of the pubs in Moree. They arrived in the pub, and the publican asked, "Where are your papers?" And Len pointed out that they hadn't lived on a reserve for a very long time, since childhood, that he was a pilot. And this was given short shrift by the publican, who called the police, and they both spent the night This was the way it happened in country towns in Australia in the 40s.
He couldn't show his dog tag. But there's a backstory to that as well, because there was a rule that said Aboriginal enlisted men were not allowed to wear their uniforms and go drinking. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, Len was in mufti at the time, and the idea of him being a pilot, a fighter pilot, was just treated with disdain by those that are in the pub at that time.
Extraordinary. As someone wrote about the injustice of the fact that Aboriginal enlisted men couldn't go to pubs in their uniforms, but
that's right.
Italian citizens with whom we were at war were able to.
Exactly.
Both an injustice, by the way, but a story for another day.
Yeah, that was Johnson, the MP for I think the Riverina area. He made that very point.
Yes. Now, Peter, Len's mother was very religious, I believe. What was she proud of her son's achievements?
Very much so. Grace was the brains of the family, and as a child, she'd grown up learning the Bible, and she was fond of quoting the Bible at home in those days, in those years at Indy Gully. This helped to bring a sense of firm values into the family. All the children, this was a big family, 11 children, and Grace would quote the Bible to make points to ensure that the children grew up with values that she believed were the right values.
So did Len carry forward a religious faith himself?
Not really. Kept those firm values, but he didn't really embrace religion. He was a spiritual man, but not a religious man in the same way that his mother was.
Yeah, interesting. Now, he was married, and after the war, his wife found it difficult to get a widow's pension.
Yes, that's right. She was knocked back when Len died, and it took a concerted effort by politicians to ensure that she did get a pension. And in the end, it was a modest pension, but nonetheless, she did get a pension that was her right and due.
Why was it hard for her to get a pension after his death?
In Len's later life, he unfortunately became an alcoholic. And this played an important role, a major role in his death. Now, Gladys, his widow, contended that the alcoholism had been brought on by his experience in World War II. This was initially rejected, but then a second attempt, it was accepted when there was evidence brought to bear, psychological evidence brought to bear, that this indeed would have been the case.
Well, let's talk about that. And you mentioned it at the start of our conversation, Peter. And our guest is Peter Rees. He's the author of The Missing Man, the story of Len Waters, Aboriginal fighter pilot in World War II. He was demobilised then. And just how did that all work out?
This was at a time when the Air Force was drastically and rapidly cutting numbers. The RAAF was about the fourth biggest air force in the world at one point in 1945. It was no war to fight. It did not need the numbers that it had. So it was demobilising people, encouraging them to leave. And Len did, because he thought that he would be able to play a part in the nation's emerging aviation future. He had hoped to get a job as a pilot with Qantas, but Qantas was really wanting bomber command pilots, because they had flown multi-engined aircraft, they'd flown with crew, and they'd flown at night, whereas fighter pilots, by their very nature, they flew alone, and of course they were flying during daylight hours. So the airlines, the commercial airlines, were in a position to pick and choose. So the opportunity for having a job with Qantas and other commercial airlines was therefore not really on the cards for Len or indeed many other fighter pilots. Mm. So it was the opportunity of setting up a regional airline taxi service out of St. George, where he lived, where the family lived, that provided his opportunity for what he hoped would be a flying future. He had secured financial backing for the aircraft from a local businessman, and all he needed was his license, his commercial pilot's license. And therein lies the problem, Stephen, because he wrote five times to the Department of Civil Aviation seeking this license, and in these letters of application, of course, one had to state where they were born. And he naturally stated that he had been born on an Aboriginal reserve. Mm. And this was enough, it seems, because he received no responses, no replies from the department.
Really?
This, the mere fact that he stated that he'd been born on an Aboriginal reserve seems to have been the only reason. Mm. It's the only explanation that stands up that for his failure to be given a license.
Goodness me. Peter, as an author, as you peel back the layers and uncover this story of this man who fought so hard for what he achieved, and then, you know, we the Air Force, everyone just let him down at the end, how did it make you feel?
Well, it really makes you reflect on how this nation has treated its Indigenous people.
Yeah.
It's good enough for them to go to war to defend the country, but then when that war is over, to see them being forced back into second-class citizenship is a very troubling thing to have to deal with, I think.
And then when that leads to, you might say, the almost inevitable downward slide into alcohol abuse and other ills, for his wife to be denied a pension on the basis of that as well at first, really rubs salt into that wound. You've called the book The Missing Man. What was behind the choice of that title?
Well, two things, Stephen. When Len died in 1993, he'd been brought back into the RAF, into the bosom of the RAF. They'd only a few weeks beforehand flown him around outback Queensland, taking him to Aboriginal communities so that he could talk to Aboriginal youth and inspire them, encourage them to think big as he did.
And so there was some sort of reconciliation before he dies, what you're saying?
Oh, that's right.
Right.
Very much so. And, I mean, the RAF realised that they were dealing with somebody special here. It was only in the late 80s that it became apparent that Len was the only Aboriginal fighter pilot in World War II. Mm. And so the RAF realised that he had a special place in the history of the service. And when he died, only a few weeks after, literally less than 2 months after he'd been on this tour of outback Queensland, the RAF made a Hercules available to fly his old comrades from 78th Squadron up to St. George for the funeral. And there was an exercise that was being planned in the Northern Territory on that very day of the funeral. And it was arranged that the F/A-18 Hornets leaving Williamtown Air Base to take part in this exercise would just slightly deviate their flight path over St. George, over the cemetery, at the time that Len was being buried. And in the time-honoured tradition of the Air Force, one aircraft peeled off in the missing man formation.
Yes, one man missing.
And to me, it seemed like this was a very apt metaphor for Len's life. The man who created this record, this unique place in Australian military history in World War II, who had hoped to play, as I say, a a role in the nation's emerging aviation future post-war. Yeah. He'd been unable to do this, and he'd become the missing man.
Wow. Well, Peter, it's a great work that you've done by revealing more of his story. The book is called The Missing Man, From the Outback to Tarakan, the Powerful Story of Len Waters. Peter Rees is the author, and Allen & Unwin is the publisher. Peter, thank you so much for doing the story. Thank you for speaking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Stephen.
Isn't it a fascinating story? It's a good read too, The Missing Man by Peter Rees.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.